Where are we going? Welcome to this exclusive podcast produced by Spirit Watch Ministries that will show where life in our darkening times is now turning and how you can avoid the detours of deception through the hope of biblical truth. The Lord Jesus in Matthew 24 warned us over 2 millennia ago and how urgently we need to heed him now. Our host is Pastor Rafael Martinez, a seasoned Northwest Indiana-based minister, intercessor, and counter-cult apologist who will help you discern the journey of change we're all on as the last day of the last days now winds down. For more information, check out our Facebook page and our website at spiritwatch.org. Now, here's Pastor Rafael.
Thank you for downloading. This is Rafael Martinez, a minister in the Church of God Cleveland Movement, and I'm the director of Spirit Watch Ministries, an outreach of Christian discernment since 1993, now based in Hammond, Indiana. This podcast is called Where Are We Going? And it's our ongoing exploration of the depths of depravity found in our fallen world today, manifesting through religiously and psychologically abusive cultism. Part of the recovery from cultism is a return back to that which was lost to it. And we make no apology for upholding this simple principle. Shattered faith can be rebuilt, but must be understood for what it is and what it does to those it grievously wounds. Over the years, we've used research, interviews, and conversations with those who are directly impacted by cults to give our podcast the unique voices they have. Our podcasting, therefore, enables us to gain a Christian perspective as well into some very dark worlds of authoritarian spiritual and social slavery, for which, we hold, the light of Jesus Christ alone can guide the way out to true freedom, true peace, and true purpose. His imminent return to this world of woe is heralded by the rise of the slickest of deceptions as he warned his disciples in Matthew chapter 24 in the New Testament. We are only doing as he's commanded there, charging that you take heed that no man deceive you. Our podcast today continues with part two of a series of interviews we had with Michael S. Black, formerly Michael Shamblin, the son of the late cult leader Gwen Shamblin Lara, who was the founder of the Way Down Workshop and the self-appointed leader and prophet of the Remnant Fellowship Church of Franklin, Tennessee. We've said from day one of our ministry that we have no interest in contributing to the last days of deception now at hand, and we've always preached, published, and defended biblical Christian truth and perspective that shows it for what it is. Our podcast today now continues with a perspective on the abuses and outrages that this movement has committed in the name of God, which were highlighted in the HBO Max docuseries The Way Down that our ministry helped to launch in 2021, the same year Gwen met her Maker and stood before the judgment seat of Christ himself. We're thankful for Michael's contributions today. You felt you were serving righteousness. You felt that anyone differing from the order that Gwen had set before you certainly had to be suspect, certainly had to be corrected, certainly had to be fought against if necessary, if not absorbable.
Right.
And that is something that you certainly tried to embody in what you were doing. And that basically where the Remnant vision really, really took off was around that. And I can certainly understand why she would use that the movie as a proverb. And speaking of which, that commando thing we were talking about, you like you said, you went commando for Remnant. And I think it was at this point, I think you've indicated that you began to start seeing things that perhaps you didn't quite see before. And we were discussing before we made our call here about how I got involved. And at that point, I think it was about 2002. I was asked by Adam Brooks, who's been on our podcast here in the past, as in some of our Spirit Watch live stream conversations, Adam Brooks he never had joined Remnant, but he and his wife were Way Down Workshop participants. Mm-hmm. And as participants, they were very involved in New York City, mm-hmm. where Manhattan, where the Way Down Workshop branch was. And in any case, we won't rehearse it all here, but he had quite a story in which he finally got disillusioned from it and finally left. And then he came back and was being contacted by, when he came back to himself and began to reassert a more normal spiritual life after he left Way Down Workshop. He never was quite accepted for Remnant because of his questioning Gwen too much. Mm-hmm. And that's something you don't do and live to tell the tale, not in the same form anyway.
Oh yeah, I remember her and the Angers talking about Adam Brooks all the time.
Yeah. And so what they did, they came together with a group of people who were part of those families that were being direly impacted by the Remnant vision. There were families whose children, whose husbands, whose wives, they were all basically disconnecting from to go join the Remnant Fellowship, to join the church at the very early onset. And so there was a meeting at which I was asked to come share. And I was at that point with my first wife, Joy, living in Cleveland, Tennessee, the real holy city of the Bible Belt. And I was living there, and our ministry was going on. We were battling cults and isms and all kinds of things there. And then we were asked to come in and sit in and see what input we could offer. At that point, he sent me tapes of the Way Down Workshop Advanced Course and the book. And at that point, I began seeing some really serious red flags. And I put together a discussion about it, and I was going to share a talk on that. And this talk was going to be at a Church of Christ in the area there. And it was while this meeting was going to go on that all these fans were converge and share and talk and share their concerns. And Adam and me and others were going to be there. And I remember walking into the place. And I remember immediately getting out of the car, greeting everybody there, and feeling immediately eyeballs on my backside. Mm-hmm. I mean, I felt it. I knew there were people there. It's just my South Chicago roots. I'm always sensitive towards stuff like that. Right. People may wonder out there why black people and Latinos look at you as you drive by them, and you may feel what? Well, that's the reason why, because we're always looking for what somebody might try to be doing to get us. So that's kind of where I was. I'm always mm-hmm. like that. I remember walking in the building, and I remember feeling those eyeballs. I felt someone's watching me. So I just started sauntering very slowly and carefully toward the building. And it was at that point, from what I understand, that you had you have a part in this story that you can tell that's quite interesting. I think you should share that now.
Yeah. So yeah, I would consider that probably was one of Remnant's first, like, you know, special ops type missions that happened, and I was a part of it. And so we had gotten word through some anonymous source that there was going to be this meeting. And so people had been spying on it, scoping it out, some of the guys. And so Gwen, you know, sets up kind of Ashlawn's headquarters on that. And I was a part of the group of guys. We took two or three trucks out to that area that y'all were in. And it's kind of a pretty heavily wooded area, West Nashville. And I mean, I was, you know, dressed in camo and everything, and we went and we took cameras, and Joseph Langston was kind of heading it up, and there were other guys. Brandon Hanna was there, Jonathan Walters was there. There was, you know, probably 6 to 8 of us, and then we're in the trees, you know, watching the building that y'all are meeting in.
Yeah.
So you weren't wrong. We were there, and we were literally like down on, like, crawling on our bellies through these trees, getting close to the open field near where the building was filming.
Right. Yeah.
And it was, wow, you talk about it. It was a rush, you know, gets your blood pressure up. And I remember at the end, like, it was pretty scary because somebody must have tipped somebody off that there's people out here.
And that was me, because I
Was that
walked in
you?
and I told the host there, somebody's out there, and you guys might want to be aware of that. From what I understand, actions were taken.
So you were the one. So anyway, so then there were all of a sudden guys on four-wheelers started driving around. And I remember they drove by looking, they were looking for people out there, and they drove by. We were in the trees completely, motionless, but they drove by probably what, 15, 20 feet away from us, driving by. And so then whenever at that point we realized they're watching, it's somebody's gonna get in big trouble here. And so we all make our way back to the trucks and head back to Ashland and report to Gwen and set up the video cameras. And because we were trying to identify who was there. That was kind of the overall, goal of the mission. So does I say quote unquote mission. That was the goal of the mission, was to identify which family members were a part of this, whose father and mother were going to come to this meeting that was being set up.
What was your impression of that? I think you just mentioned to me that I think it for the first time you began really wondering whether or not this attempt to root out agents and stuff like that, this whole matrix mindset might be a little bit off.
And that's, that you immediately, I'm going through my mind is, I don't think other churches are doing this. And it was, there's a little bit of there's a frightening part of it a little bit. Maybe that particular day I wasn't feeling that way, but not long after that, I was concerned because I could see that was kind of the beginning of what would later become Remnant's massive security team and army that was being built up. But that was kind of the beginning, and you could see kind of the how the whole thing could work because you've got, men who are, they're like in a trance. They, these women or Gwen have put them in a trance, and they would do anything for Gwen. And I started, nervously seeing that because I was doing it too, protecting Zion, right? For the sake of protecting Zion, that was kind of the thing. And
Were you there the following morning when those tapes were actually viewed and people were there and saw their parents in the videos?
what we did it that night. We came back and watched
That
it that
night.
night.
Okay, was it that night? Okay, I thought it was the morning. Tell me if it was the
No,
morning.
we went right back in that night at Ashlawn. Like I said, Gwen had set up the house like a headquarters, so there was a ton of people there. We came back, and that was, we were big, big shots that night. It was, but no, I mean, honestly, honestly was so glad we didn't get caught. That was, we did get caught in a way because somebody knew we were there, but we didn't get caught. They didn't stop us. But
But I'm sure
yeah.
that fired up your whole anti your whole line, your this engagement where you feel like you're taking on evil and you
Right.
win.
And that to me though was kind of that's the scary part of it because you have these men, and I've already mentioned the problem with the passivity of the men, but also the desire to please. And the women, Gwen knew all too well how to use sympathy as a weapon or a tool, and she would teach the women to do that. And you could see how this could turn into the men were okay with breaking laws. They were okay with doing something outside of bounds. Gwen's word was considered more important than law. Her word was considered like Moses. And people, I don't think the average person really understands it. They don't believe it when I say it or you say it. It really was.
You're right. You're right. People don't understand just how exalted a cult teaching becomes. I mean, Robert J. Lifton, the gentleman, the psychologist whose work I base so much of my response to cult mind controlling people, posited 8 different aspects of what he believed will show you what where cult mind control is working. And one of these, well, you've mentioned several of them here. I didn't have a chance to even stop and catalog, but at this point, you're talking about what's called the sacred science, that this cult group comes up with this truth that is so inviolable, so completely high and lifted up that it cannot be ignored. It cannot be defied. It has to be defended at all costs. And the fact that Gwen sent you on that mission, in keeping with that remnant matrix mindset, you know, you're the freedom fighters trying to deliver the bound. That just shows just how powerful. I mean, I can go on and on about this cult mind control thing, but this is one point of it.
Yeah, and Remnant to me crosses the line from a lot of other cults because they would physically do things. You know, a lot of other places may, you know, it's like, you know, not hypnosis, but it's not mind control only, but it's just a lot of words that can get you to do things you don't like. But Remnant would physically do things. They get people to do things like breaking the law, which is frightening. And that to me was in the name of protecting themselves, in the name of protecting Gwen. And she was constantly telling, you know, it would eventually lead to her, you know, telling security, you know, y'all need to securely make sure no one who doesn't belong in Remnant makes it in, not letting people in. And they, in turn, what was scary to me is they, in turn, start priding themselves on how obedient and how unwaveringly following they were to Gwen. She was the general, you know, like General Leia or something in Star Wars. Absolutely no matter what. And I could see the women, you know, Gwen and her assistants and people starting to take advantage of this. And I could see the men being okay with it, if that makes sense.
What kind of laws, other laws? I mean, first of all, privacy laws, just the fact that it's unethical and absolutely inappropriate to run around spying on people with video cameras, peeking on them through and then bringing their kids outside and demanding that they identify their parents. I mean, that's just absolutely a frank authoritarian nastiness. But what kind of other laws did you say that you saw being broken at that point?
Well, eventually they're breaking laws of tracking people. The information they get on people was beyond what would be considered legal. Okay. There's a point, Remnant, I could tell people so much. I mean, Remnant, you know, they do background searches on everybody. You're not supposed to do that. They have people that have law enforcement or government ties that they can do, run background searches on everybody that's ever visited. I mean, they go beyond what, it's not a church, it's a cult, it's a dangerous cult, and they're willing to break into people's houses, you know? That happened to me, but I mean, I know they did it to other people. They could get into people's houses. They would hack into people's computers, which there's illegal, you know, there's all kinds of things illegal about that. They secret recorded things that shouldn't be, you know, you're not allowed to do. They made up things about people. There was obviously monetary things that happened, governmental things that were skirting the law. And when I say illegal, I mean, they would cut a lot of corners. Let's put it that way. And, they didn't care about the law, so to speak, the word of the law. That was not what anybody was concerned with. It was Gwen's approval.
Yeah. And then easily extended to issues that involve child welfare, in which children could become pawns in custody battles.
Right.
And children could be submitted to that same authority line. From what I understand, and it was not an uncommon thing for maybe an 8 or 9 year old child to be able to execute corporal punishment against 5 year olds. That was not an uncommon thing at all.
Right. Right. And that would be, you know, fall under the category, the abuses that went on. And that was absolutely happened and absolutely was taken advantage of. It's a scary situation. And you know, I just I, to me it all it bothered me. And then, you know, down the line, like going back along the line of we were talking about, you know, the security and how that stuff was building up with Gwen, it came to a head to me, you know, this is fast forwarding, this is not the early years, but this is later on. I had a conversation with Gwen because I was the person who would, I could get away with like, not calling her out, but like going against her. I was the only person that would do that because I was in trouble all the time. So I just, that's why I was in trouble all the time. And I remember one night, because I would question her, I'd push her on things. And I'd done a lot of research on history on Christianity, right? Because I was, excuse me. I did a lot of research and questioning on the history of Christianity.
Right.
And because I think I was writing my second musical at the time, Rome is Burning. And so I had done a ton of research on, you know, early Christianity and things like that.
Okay.
And I, you know, the Christians in Rome, they were hiding out from the Romans, right? They're going to the catacombs. You didn't see them forming little armies and going out and, you know, tying up the Roman soldiers and chopping their heads off, right? You don't hear about that in the New Testament. Or any church history, right? So right. So in my mind, I'm going, something doesn't line up here, because we are meeting out the justice. We have become the judge, jury, and executioner. Gwen has become the judge, jury, executioner, and the prophet. And I questioned her one night. We all went to a restaurant, and she had had some wine, and it was probably eight people there, leaders and people like that there. And I decided to question her because I was really, at this point, pretty nervous. And I said, because I had heard her talking about something like this, and I said, so if somebody's coming down the Remnant Drive, and you know they are opposed to you and coming, you know, whatever, coming after you, I said, what would you do? She said, I'd have them shot, taken out. And so I gave her a second chance. I said, okay, so somebody's coming down the Remnant Drive, and you know that, you know, they have bad intentions towards you, they don't like you, you would have them shot and killed? She said, yes. And so that to me that night, so I go, what about, where did Christianity fall into all this? Where does Christianity fall into this whole church picture? What happened to turn the other cheek? What happened to, why am I not reading about this? I've read Fox's Book of Martyrs. What is this? What are we a part of? You know, and these are some big questions I was having to ask myself. She didn't like that I was asking that, putting her on the spot.
This is a group of people listening to all this.
Oh, yeah. Eight, like seven other people. And they just, you know.
I don't suppose they offered any input to that, did they?
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
Yeah. And afterwards, I left afterwards and went somewhere and just kind of wrote about it. Sulked. I mean, I was pretty upset. I was upset because I was going, what has it become? Because they're willing to mete out punishment to people. They're willing to, you know, like I told Phil Williams, you know, these guys, they think Remnant is some sweet little dance party. You know, their wife's going to go visit in Nashville and go to a dance party and a wedding and bring her kids. And then a year later, they're fighting for their life. You know, that they've been, their wife's been ripped away. Their kids are ripped away. Remnant drains you of money with their legal team. They have it down to they're a well-oiled machine at this point.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're vicious. I could see the cruelty in Gwen's eyes. And people didn't, that's where I differ from a lot of these women and a lot of people. They have the sympathy for her. I saw the cruel part. I saw and I always called them like the uncaring blue eyes that she had. There was a monster there. And I could see, I knew she would have, they, if, and here, here's another thing too, I want to say too, that what's scary, you know, I think there's a verse about this somewhere, you would know better than me, but it's like, if you're honest with something small, you'll be honest with something big. Is that like in Proverbs.
The first, if you're faithful in small things, you'll be faithful in the bigger ones.
Yes. Okay. So that, yes, thank you. And so I feel like if somebody's willing to be dishonest and break a law in a small thing, they will also be dishonest and break a law in a bigger thing.
Right.
And so I always knew, I had a feeling, Remnant, that they don't care about breaking a law. And that always bothered me because I know something's going to happen. You know, they don't care. That was their
anti-authority to me.
Yeah. Well,
whatever happened to authority and submission and all that, you know, being a good Christian follower of the law and doing the right thing. It didn't matter when it came down to remnant law, according to Gwen.
Right. And her word, she was the law.
Right.
And she could clearly change the law, because if you notice in the later years when she comes out and divorces David Shamblin and she has her new, you know, divorce doctrine, that she could change it will, and people go along with it.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Where were you at when it came to the authority line? I mean, within the remnant those days, I mean, you were becoming a worship leader. You were being active. I mean, who would have been over you, if anyone, within that early remnant leadership circle?
Well, Gwen, obviously, and you can make a Ted and David Martin. You can make a strong case, and Joseph Langston, though they would say that I, you know, was probably not the best at being under their authority. But
But they were nominally those who you were submissive to.
I was kind of in a different category, because I literally was one of the first three people of Remnant. You know, I was there in the room with Gwen and me and my sister when she told us about Remnant. I mean, I was there from the beginning. There was a kind of a different treatment in a way.
Right.
I was a founder, which I'm unfortunately to say now, but I was a founder. And so I think that was kind of a little bit of a different situation somewhat.
And that I would say that'd be the same for your sister, right?
Right.
She also was accorded an authority that she didn't walk over.
And people that have said, you know, the documentaries and things, they're not wrong. They're right. You know, that it was kind of a royal type family type thing. Yeah, there's a lot of truth to that.
Right.
Because Elizabeth or me, you know, people could say something to Ted or Dave or give them direction or something, but they would still check in with Gwen, obviously. But there was some sort of kind of royal family treatment like that.
Oh, yeah. A lot of the ex-members, I'm aware, we often use that term, that you guys were part of remnant royalty.
Mm-hmm.
And we weren't wrong. And we knew that because of the treatment and the absolute deference you guys got there. Now, speaking of that, very early on in your lives, your sister, and I'm going to ask some a little more pointed questions here, and I hope you understand. I'm not meaning there's any disrespect to her or you or your family, but your sister appeared to have a much more normal physical health and a figure, and was a lively young lady. She was a very active, very dynamic person. I've read, you know, and she was a cheerleader, I believe, at Lipscomb University, and she became a very dynamic speaker. I mean, at what point did she start actually becoming a speaker? Was she leading Bible studies? How did she start moving? How did you start finding out she had this gift of speaking?
How did she find out?
That start manifesting within Remnant those days?
I always felt she was more of a speaker than I was, as far as even the early, you know, the way down videos and things like that. I didn't have as much problem with being on a stage, though. And sorry, I'm getting something here, trying to mute this stuff. I think she was naturally more of a speaker, like Gwen. She's gotten that gift, and you know, where she could just talk for hours. She could talk to a wall for hours, you know. She was that much of a speaker. And it developed over time. I think she was part of, we were all part of counseling early on in Remnant.
Okay.
So we spent a lot of time counseling people all the time. I did too. I mean, we were just every day, and that was kind of our part of our job. And she always was doing that. She was always counseling. She was more of a close in, she liked to be more of the homebody type with Gwen. She wanted to be kind of the close in with Gwen. I was a little more of the free spirit, kind of rebellious type, maybe possibly, but she was in there close, and she was always speaking, and she wanted to be like Gwen, and that was something different than me and her always felt different. I didn't want to be like Gwen. She wanted to be like Gwen. And
Right.
over time, she would talk, and I think it actually was, this is kind of, people don't know this. She actually went through some difficult times where she felt like left out. She felt like Gwen was the speaker and Michael does the music. She would confess that to us. She would talk about that. And Gwen's like, "No, your day's gonna come. You've got the gift of speaking." She was always looking for that, but she clearly has the gift of speaking. She clearly has the she's able to get up there and do what Gwen did,
And she is. She
She is.
I watched her throughout the years and different things, different webcasts and things. She definitely has a gift for speaking and being able to project herself. So, and that's not a problem. I'm just saying, I just wondered how much of that was being developed in those years. But one thing I do want to ask you about that, and I take no pleasure in having to do that, but I have to ask you this question. It seems obvious to anyone outside that Amen circle of remnant that's still there that your sister is really seems to be really languishing under a serious eating disorder of some sort. And that's profoundly concerning. I mean, and as the years go by, it just seems like she seems more and more gaunt, enthralled to that. When she married and bore children, it just seemed to get worse. And then sadly, when you lost your nephew there, her first child, during the Remnant Passover in 2012, of all times, that certainly would be a shock that, as we know, something Gwen would have demanded she internalize to look within and to not really allow it to really impact or show on her. How is she, in what ways did Gwen's influence contribute to that disorder she's struggling? What was Gwen doing or saying to her that had really steered her onto this path? I think she really seems to believe that to be as absolutely skin, I mean skin and bones that she almost seems to be is the righteous way to live. I mean, I'm trying to understand it, but how did Gwen's influence combine to that eating disorder?
Well, it th this is it's complicated.
It
She's something of like a big mystery to a lot of people, and I do feel like I know her personality pretty well at this point. But there were a couple of things that happened, and one of them obviously being the child, that's been pretty well covered by a lot of people. There was another thing that did happen, though, at one point. There was a situation. So Elizabeth was very much of a homebody the
Right.
last decade before Gwen passed away. She stayed home, and there was a time period where we were traveling. I would always travel. Brandon would actually travel without Elizabeth because she just didn't want to travel. She wanted to stay home, and she always would have the youth over to her house. That was kind of her thing. Her comfort was having the youth over, and she'd have her glass of wine, and they just loved Elizabeth. She could talk to them and didn't feel, judged. And so we were on a trip one time, and we went to Europe, and it was a 2 week long trip. And during this time period, Elizabeth was starting to kind of make some decisions at the church, and she kind of, I think people were checking in with her, and she started getting a little more comfortable with that and running the kids and making some, I think Gwen called it in her early sermon, sitting in the magic chair. Do you remember that? She used to call it sitting in the magic chair, like the throne. And so Elizabeth was sitting in the throne a little bit. And when we came back, Elizabeth kind of, they had a little bit of a thing against each other. Gwent actually called Elizabeth out publicly, like in front of a lot of people. And she got publicly corrected by Gwen for, you know, kind of like, you know, you need to know your place, daughter, in front of a lot of people. And it affected her. And here's the difference in me and Elizabeth. That happened, you know, how many times I got corrected by Gwen, I can't count. But she was the type that, she was the type that could hold a very serious, hateful grudge, just like Gwen.
Yeah.
And it did something to her, and she was just as evenly, masterfully cruel as Gwen was. And she remembered who her enemies were, or anybody that slighted her. So she was a person not to lightly say something, you know, close to threatening or insulting, because she will not forget it. And that did something to her, that being called out. So she really gave, you know, Gwen a run for her money there for a while. And that was after the stuff with the child, too. So she started looking different, you know, losing all that weight. She was complaining, you know, their marriage, her and Brandon's marriage was not great. I think people think it was not.
Right.
But Gwen would call me and say, pray for your sister. And that's the kind of stuff, I wish I had recorded that, because nobody would believe me. Everybody would think I'm the one who had the sin, you know. I'm the one whose sins were obvious, you know. I'm the guy that the sins, everybody knows my sins. But Elizabeth, they did not realize that. And, she harbored that inside of her. There was hatred towards Gwen. And, and I want to say, too, she's also got some of the psychological things that have come up over that time period as well. Like you said, early on, she was very, I think they use in HBO, they say she's very bubbly, effervescent or something like that. Very social, very likable. And then over time, you know, she's changing into a little bit different of a person. And I saw situations like it's possibly a form of bipolar with Elizabeth.
Okay.
And this is, people don't understand this who just members, but Gwen had the same issue as well. Gwen had the issues of one day she would, you know, this is Gwen. One day she would want to be some majorly evangelistic popular person. And she would scramble and have the whole leadership and marketing team, you know, trying to put together a way down tour or something. Like, I mean, all day, we'd meet all day. And then the very next day, I kid you not, once everybody's already worked hard to put everything together, she would calmly walk into the office and say, you know, I want everybody to be concerned if you're trying to make Remnant grow with marketing and these way down tours, because that's not how it's going to happen. And she would say, like, God, what's, you know, she'd have people worried, like, God's going to strike him down if that's what they felt. And she would say, here's how Remnant's going to grow. It's going to grow from within, Zion babies. And so she'd cancel the tour. She was literally like bipolar. It drove people insane.
Yeah.
And Elizabeth has that same kind of pattern that I've noticed that Gwen had.
Yeah.
And
very much an on the fly kind of management style, very impulsive.
Yes, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah,
that's a good one. And the only thing they never waver on is the complete authority and power in their godlike position and wanting to be worshipped. That's the only thing Gwen and Elizabeth have never wavered on.
Right. So that's
I've been concerned with her. You know, I've been concerned with the physical appearance, and I don't really like to go into it a whole lot. I do know more things than I've let on.
Right.
I have been concerned about what goes on at Ashlawn. And, you know, medication and things like that. I know she's been through things too. I'm not, you know,
exactly.
I'm not an idiot, but
Yeah, there's not. I'm not asking the question to scandalize whatsoever.
Yeah.
And Elizabeth, if you're listening, I want you to know this. We are concerned for you. I genuinely always have been concerned for you and your family. And I'm asking if your religion is something you're going to die for by starving yourself to death. Mm-hmm. Is that really what biblical Christianity is all about? I would submit to you, no, it is not. Righteousness does not come as to the degree of body fat you have. It comes with the amount of love you have for your enemies. And that to me is the measure of what the Christian faith is. That's what Jesus stood for. And my concern for you, Elizabeth, if you're listening, is that you start looking, you really look within, and that you start really reconsidering what you're doing there and how it's actually not helping you, and that you're really on a sinking ship. You're on a Titanic heading for the bottom right now, and that you need a reconsideration. I'm asking these questions because I do care. I want her to seek the help that she really needs. And if she's ever really going to truly be a genuine shepherd there in Remnant, or where the true believer is still there, then she needs a really serious review of herself and where she's at. And Elizabeth, I know you'll be listening to this at some point. I think you will. And I'm just going to observe, as I've seen throughout the years, that I have a really great zeal for God. And I think a fear of your mother. You bear within yourself the physical and social consequences of assuming a burden she wanted you to bear, or may have been thrust upon you, that was being the leader Remnant. You know, and it's our concern. That's why we're even bringing this up, that it's our concern that how far that zeal has brought you, and it's been terribly misguided. This is the only reason why we're even discussing this, you know. I think you'd feel the same way, wouldn't you, Michael?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We're bringing this up because of our concern, not just for her, but for everyone who looks up to her. There's a sizable generation of young men and women for whom she's been an example. And Elizabeth, there's dozens of them. You know who they are, their families as well, and everyone involved in all that circle. Mm-hmm. And you're the walking manifestation of perfection to them. And yet we know that you're hardly that, as any of us are, including me, starting with me. None of us are perfect. And all of us can make mistakes, but you've made some pretty serious ones. And I know they go on. They're without measure. And again, I'm not trying to ask you to be a narc or anything like that, Michael. But I do know that's, unfortunately, a hallmark of poor leadership and immature ones at that point. You know, I remember a story Mindy Munoz was telling me, and she remembered how Elizabeth critically savaged her and that of her daughter Monique when they were late in getting back to her one day as they came to care for her sadly departed son. I guess he had just been born, was a few months old, and they were late getting back to her and they just wanted to get a gift. They wanted to get gifts for him. And that what she remembers very vividly just how brutal that your sister was. And that's just in one way that she was treating the sheep of her flock. And I can't imagine that this is just one example.
Right. No, it's not. And it's, I think it's something that's been a long time coming. And I know she learned a lot from imitating Gwen.
Right.
Clearly.
Right.
And Gwen, as we've all known, I think, did a better job of hiding that. She was behind closed doors, and I know other people have said this as well, but, you know, when she was, I mentioned, you know, I think to Phil Williams, when she would take people behind closed doors
mm-hmm.
and, you know, give them the business, but I think Elizabeth has not been as seemingly caring about how it comes across, possibly. I think it's a possibility that she just doesn't. She almost, I've wondered myself possibly if she even gets something of a thrill from having a reputation of being someone not to mess with, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Total sense. Absolutely. People want to be loved and feared. You know, I remember that classic moment in A Bronx Tale, in which one of the gangsters there were being asked that question by a young protege he was talking to, and he asked that question: is it better to be loved or feared? And but you know, the sad thing is, Michael, that love sometimes takes some very strange colors, doesn't it?
It does, and I don't think anyone could have fully predicted how this was going to turn out, you know, since the plane crash, you know, once it took out all those leaders, you know, she's taken over the role of being the next Gwen Chandlin Lara.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's, and it's been kind of, it can come across creepy at times, even down to speaking slower like Gwen,
mm-hmm.
you know, talking sweetly when she wants to win over the mindless remnant sheep, you know, and through some of these things you're talking about, I think she's made herself hated as well by mm-hmm. some.
Yeah.
And she, with this trying to be completely feared, man, as far as making it absolutely clear, no one is to speak negatively, right? Or even come close to question any of her actions, you know, or mm-hmm. her words. And that's been obviously documented. Got tons of proof of that.
Yeah. And that's the kind of example behind closed doors you're talking about that actually exists. It's exhibits. It could be produced. It's been testified to, you mm-hmm. know. You know, it's you have to ask the question, Elizabeth, where are you going to actually leave people with that kind of abuse?
Right.
You don't see it as much, but as our podcast has asked the proverbial question, where are you going? Where are you going to go with what happens when the supply of people to abuse runs out? That's what's going on right now.
And that's a very good point. I probably about 2 years ago, I started getting more in touch with a lot of ex-members that were, you know, starting to leave the church, especially around the time of the interview. But I would sometimes take them to lunch, things like that. And I remember some of them. I'm not going to mention their names because they probably mm-hmm. would not want that.
Yeah.
But, you know, there were some women I heard about, some of these women that, I mean, churches would kill to have members like this at their church.
Mm-hmm.
They were the lifeblood of Remnant. They had sacrificed years. They would volunteer and go to the prisons every weekend to go visit the prisoners on their own time every weekend.
Yeah.
They were the first ones to wear the way down t-shirts and be on the front row for Gwen. And these people, because of this situation of zero tolerance for questions or criticism, I mean, they are brought in, I call it brought in before the Sanhedrin. You know, they would bring him in before the leaders, and you would have Amy Stites and some of Elizabeth's top generals now, her women, her guidance ladies, which have kind of become her heavies, you know, the bouncers or whatever. They're the Naomi, and you have Patrick Stites and Eldon Gormson, and brought in and questioned these sweet old ladies. And because they were merely, you know, maybe asking questions about why Elizabeth wasn't attending church yet. Keep in mind, this is still like 2 years ago.
Yeah, recent. This is recent history. Yeah.
You know, why asking, you know, just basic questions, not in a nasty way, not trying to cast shade on Elizabeth, but it was just out of questions like, and these were the type of people too, what was so wild about it, were the very ones actually putting into practice what, you know, these very seriously messed up, in my opinion, teachings Remnant was giving them about checking in with the line of authority under everything, right? Asking your small group leaders. They were the first ones to be checking in with their small group leaders. And they were being brought in, and when they would report that stuff, and then they're asked to leave. They're brought in and questioned. simply because of asking basic questions. These people in this church, they have huge amounts of fear because they're constantly seeing people, you know, routinely just disappearing without warning, you know, removed from the directory or kicked out of the church just for these simple common sense type questions. And I knew something was majorly off. You have to understand something's majorly off when, like you said, how far is this going to go?
Right. Exactly. And this is recent history, you're telling them. This is what you've heard.
This is recent history, right. This is within the last two, right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Since the interview. And it's been horrible.
Yeah. But let's flash back to kind of a little bit more. If these same sort of people had at the time of Remnant's resurgence, as Remnant began to grow from the early 2000s onward, you would have been a part of the authority line, making sure that they got dragged in there, wouldn't you? I mean, that kind of dissent, as it would have been viewed, was certainly intolerable then as it is now. Gwen certainly wouldn't have been a lot more quick about doing that, wouldn't she?
Well, I just felt like Gwen went about it in a more calculated way.
Right.
That's to me, Elizabeth lacks some of the tact that Gwen had.
Right.
And people would be brought in, but Gwen would always have it to where, you know, Ted or some of these other people would be making the hard statements. But Gwen also left it was harder for people to say things like that about Gwen,
right?
Because she was showing up at all the events. She was at every single thing. We can say a lot about Gwen, but she wasn't lazy.
Right. Right.
And she wasn't stupid. No, she put in the work. I will at least give her that. She put in the work. As horrific as this whole thing has been, she, you know, gave up her time. She was all the time, every day.
Right. And she had to, because the entire movement, the entire enterprise of the Way Down Workshop, as well as the Remnant Fellowship, all the auxiliaries that grew out of it, they all rotated around, you know, around her energy, her direction,
right,
her guidance.
Right.
She was the micromanager par excellence.
Yes.
As you mentioned, the kind of discipline, the kind of checking in that she would personally mete out, always was more nuanced. It was much more sweet, like I said, and gentle, and that was her initial example as to how she got things done. I've heard many people testify to that, to how nice she could be in making you feel like absolute trash.
Right, and that's why it would be such a shock for a lot of these people when HBO and things came out. They had not seen that side of her. And I'll give you an example to show you the difference. You know, this maybe gives some sort of contrast. But right after the plant, now this is not early on. We can go back to early, or, you know, years back. But right after the plane crash, the contrast with Elizabeth, you know, we had this huge leadership Zoom call that I was on. We're talking, you know, probably well over 100 people. And it was, in my opinion, maybe 2 weeks after the crash. And in my opinion, this was extraordinarily inappropriate. And it was shocking. It was horrible to all of these, you know, they're pathetic with their tears. You know, these pieces of trash leaders who'd served Gwen and Elizabeth and everybody for so many years. These people were in tears on this call, and Elizabeth gets on there, and she said, and I kid you not, she said, "I wouldn't care if Remnant went down to only 6 people." She goes, "I don't care." And so she's threatening these people and everyone who's listening that God was using her as the next leader prophet, I say that in quotations. Mm-hmm. But people were in shock. And by the end of the call, everyone was such in a state of just horrified. They felt need to say, you know, don't worry, Elizabeth. Don't worry. I am so behind you, Elizabeth. I'm so behind you.
Mm-hmm.
And this is 2 weeks after the crash. These people are going through the various stages of grief. And I didn't say, me and my ex, Aaron, were sitting back. Keep in mind, Elizabeth, too, she's the only one who doesn't show her face. She's a black screen. Everyone else is required to show their face. They're dressed up, sitting on their couch for the Zoom meeting. Elizabeth's just a black screen. And because the rules don't apply to her. And it was just in your face. I don't care if it's only six of you left. If you don't get behind me. And it was I think that's a sharp contrast to how Gwen, as you would know, would lead.
Yeah. So she was an absolute advocate of this strategy where she was going to threaten the world with ending the entire world, the entire Zion. I mean, she wouldn't have cared if the machines made it to the city or not. She didn't care as long as she had enough to survive.
And she reminded me of that, Raph. And since you're a minister, it reminded me of a certain passage in the Bible, and I don't remember what it was, but perhaps you will. But it was a king that took over after his father, the king, died, and he made some sort of comment about my little finger is thicker than my father's waist, or something like he was going to put more of a yoke on the people. Do you remember that?
Oh yeah, that was the, I don't remember the names. I do know the story. The story was that there was a king who died, I think it was Solomon. Yeah, it was Solomon's son. It's terrible. Minish doesn't know all this, but it's been a while since I read the passage. Solomon had died. He had been ruthlessly, even though he's the wisest guy in the Bible, he was ruthlessly challenging the nation of Israel, which was at its height of power at the point. He was challenging them to lay aside and lay up treasures and work ferociously to help build the temple, the first temple. And then at that point, Solomon's son, gosh, it's terrible. I should know this, but I don't remember his name. But anyway, the point is Solomon's son took aside two groups of men. One were his father's former leaders, and one were his band of peers, his homeboys. I mean, one group was his group of his father's leaders who were all wise men, and all said, "Listen, if you'll treat the people right, if you'll speak kindly to them, if you'll treat them, you know, humanely, you speak softly to them, they'll follow you forever. If that's what we counsel you to do." And then he went to his homies, or they're all doing their thing somewhere, hanging out, asking, what should I say to these people now? And they said, "Listen, you should tell them I'm going to beat you within an inch of your life." This is the Raphael International version. Okay, this is just
me. Like the Raphael International
version. All right. Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Well, I'm sure
within an inch of your life.
Well, yeah, he would, and that's exactly what he said. He said, "I'm going to treat you. If you thought you had things rough now or rough in my father's time, wait until you see what I'm going to bring to you."
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that's what the point you're trying to make. So you're going to see my father treated you with whips. I'm going to treat you with scorpions or something like that. But the point is, he made it clear that things were going to get a whole lot tougher in my day. And this is the way it was going to be.
And it was very. And it seemed very clear that there would be huge problems for anybody that had even a second's worth of doubt. Mm-hmm. About Elizabeth, and you know, she felt need to come in with this yoke of iron to put on people, and it does come in line. I think she had been prepped by Gwen for years.
Mm-hmm.
I do feel that Gwen had this in her, but Gwen just had she had more of a sense of, I don't know if it was from her upbringing or how she was raised with the Church of Christ or because of her mother or how she lived, but she had more of a, she would at least make some attempt for people to leave the room liking Gwen.
Right.
Usually. And, you know, that's the whole problem with this place. Elizabeth, she understood that, and as Gwen obviously understood, it's the absolute authoritarianism, right? And there's no accountability. And she knew that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Gwen, you know, the group authoritarian leader, which is now Elizabeth, they're the exclusive means of knowing the truth. She's going to be the only one.
Mm-hmm.
And she's going to be their only means of validation, just like Gwen. Mm-hmm. She was the only way these people could feel okay about themselves was if she was happy. And
yep. And if mama's not happy, nobody's happy, right?
Exactly. And that was it was the church version of that.
Yeah.
And she's the only one getting, and she wanted to make it very clear. And I'm talking about Elizabeth now, but Gwen did the same thing. But Elizabeth learned from Gwen. She imitated her. And she wanted to be the only one getting the direct lead from the heavens, which I know you're familiar with that phrase because that's a very common remnant language, the lead from the heavens.
The lead from the heavens.
Yep. She had God's ear with everything. And, you know, Gwen's word was the law, you know, and Elizabeth was going to step into those shoes. She was going to be Gwen version two. And she didn't want anyone to even have a doubt.
Right. There's no mistake of whose church this was now. She wanted. Yep,
She took over that role with the leader's help.
Right. And it's indicative. You know, it's just a sign of just where elitism will take you. You know, one of the hallmarks of Gwen's Church of Christ past is that restorationist view that in any given populous center where men live, the presence of the true church can exist only in an established and functioning Church of Christ. Now,
right,
Gwen took that and consolidated that to a fantastic degree, and it helped embolden her to start living that entirely different kind of life once she had that blind blind obedience that her authority demanded. And it helped just her to create that authority line you're talking about, which we've been discussing, something which Remnant absolutely runs its clock by, you know. And that's the thing, you know, Elizabeth just took that and she retooled that to her own means. You know, it's that the authority lines that socialization principle we've already talked about, that everyone is subject to a headship and directive authority over them that is supposedly more spiritually mature than they are, and it can't be questioned. It's from God, like you said, it's from the heavens.
Mm-hmm.
And Gwen established that. You became a part of that. So did Elizabeth. And there's so many places that that kind of authority, when once bestowed, started to go in creating the entire remnant shepherd structure. There are instances in which that authority line pecking order was clearly being abused, and nobody just said anything about it. I'm sure there were, but are there any specific examples that come to mind?
Yeah, as far as being abused, I would see it, you know, from leaders abusing people as far as demanding help or people like that. You know, I would say some of the top leaders could take advantage of this authority line when you've got people joining the church, right? And they're placing people in homes, and they're being completely indoctrinated. It was very easy to take somebody. You know, they wanted to control their entire lives, right? And I think, if people saw the documentary, you saw people like they moved to Brentwood, and you know, all of a sudden they're plugged in to this church system. And they're going to be cutting people's hair, or they're going to be doing this at a discount rate for Gwen and everyone. That was pretty regularly happening.
Yeah. The Exodus.
Yes, Exodus. Right.
That became like the economic compact for the church, because that's where all the skilled tradesmen and everything came in and really devoted themselves to advancing the church in the way you're talking about. And that's how
in Exodus, I'm going to be careful here speaking about Exodus, since that's still an operating entity. And I feel nowadays that a fellow named Steve Graham has come in. I appreciate how he has kept a distance from leadership, to be completely honest. And he even did that during Gwen. But when Exodus started, yes, Gwen was pulling in people under those auspices of that kind of umbrella, Exodus Industries. I would say they're a different type of animal now. They're more autonomous. A lot of people they work with now are subs that are not Remnant. It used to be exclusively Remnant. I will at least say that about them. I feel like they've made some improvements over the years.
Yeah.
But that's right. But you would see people taking advantage, not just Exodus, but other industries, right? You've got the lack of financial disclosure, which is always the big issue, right? For churches and 501c3s, and exploiting members financially, which you had situations where, like, for instance, I know for, you know, that there was, I'm not going to mention a name on this podcast. I don't feel like it's necessary.
Totally.
But there was, you know, you've got like a vision doctor that joins Remnant, and they are, you know, overcharging a lot of the senior members because they don't know any better for certain services that they could have gotten for a lot less somewhere else. And these people didn't know any better because they're all directed and steered to go to the Remnant eye doctor, the Remnant whatever. Right. And they can take advantage of that. That happened all the time.
Right. And that's just one example. I'm very aware of what you're talking about.
We can go
drop down that rabbit hole, so to speak, and speak to that forever, because that's the sort of thing. When you're having a closed community that's completely enthralled to a central authority that teaches leaders that you can only trust and you're best served only by doing all your business within that community, of course you're going to see these moments come up. First of all, it's unethical and ridiculously abusive to demand people to, you know, to only associate with one kind. It's a height of intolerance, but it's what cults do. But Gwen also
used the argument that that's what the Jews do.
Mm-hmm.
That was definitely one of her big selling points to why this was, you know, God allowed, because of always the blurred line between Remnant Christianity. I say that very loosely, Christianity and Judaism.
Right.
Because the Jews were known to be in a community, and they all used the same, you know, barber and the same, you know, meat, you know, butcher and all these in their areas, and they're able to do better financially. It's like a huge business club. Mm-hmm. And she would use that as an argument for doing it that way.
Right. Right. And we're not here to criticize, you know, one way or the other. It is what we're talking about is if when you're in that kind of community, you would expect a higher ethical standard.
Mm-hmm.
A more compassionate kind of conservatism, if we can use that word. You would expect that you would find people
giving them better deals as opposed to overcharging them.
You would hope the deals would be better. You would hope they would be treating you. You'd be getting, you know, more leeway in costs and just the stuff of life, you know.
But it was easy to abuse that because of the closed environment, because of the authority line. That did make it easier to abuse that type thing, because you don't question your leaders, right? You don't members joining don't question their small group leaders.
Mm-hmm. Right. Because the authority lines, well, obviously, if somebody's over authority, you, that they're obviously going to know better than you.
They know better. Exactly. They know better than you.
Thanks for listening today as we explore just where are we going. Our prayer is that you have been encouraged and strengthened and, if necessary, challenged in your daily journey through life. Jesus is coming. You can fall with the night or you can rise with the sun. The choice is yours. You can email us with questions and comments at feedback@spiritwatch.org. And if you need urgent personal spiritual help, email us at help@spiritwatch.org. We look forward to hearing from you. Please follow our podcasting at our Facebook page and our website at spiritwatch.org. This podcast is a production of Spirit Watch Ministries, taking heed that no man deceives you.